From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Donald Rumsfeld went to Kuwait to talk to the troops, the idea was to bolster morale, maybe pose for a few pictures. But the Secretary of Defense got a little more than he bargained for in the town hall-style meeting from Specialist Thomas Wilson of the Tennessee National Guard.
Why do we soldiers have to dig through local landfills for pieces of scrap metal and compromised ballistic glass to up-armor our vehicles? And why don't we have those resources readily available to us?
After gathering his thoughts, Secretary Rumsfeld responded that all the armor in the world might not stop a roadside bomb. But when the troops continued to press the issue, the secretary seemed to get frustrated.
You go to war with the army you have, not the army you might want or wish to have at a later time.
Easy for the top brass to say, but nearly 2 years into the Iraq War, it was GIs getting a few things off their chests yesterday. The soldiers on the ground, the men and women tasked to do the fighting that has gone on much longer and at much higher cost, including cost in their blood, than anyone was led to expect. Tonight on Point, Rumsfeld's earful from the troops and what it says about troop deployment and supplies, about planning and execution and leadership, about military morale and the war in Iraq. We begin tonight in Washington, where reaction to yesterday's testy exchange with the troops brought a wave of response today. Joining me now is Mark Mazzetti, Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Mark, thanks very much for being with us tonight. How's this televised exchange in Kuwait hitting Washington today?
Well, it's given Democrats in their mind needed a chance to be able to take shots at the Bush administration over Iraq. A string of top Democrats have come out yesterday and today criticizing Rumsfeld's comments and talking about how they're emblematic of not only a certain callousness on Rumsfeld's part, but on the lack of planning that the Bush administration had for the insurgency after the end of combat operations in Iraq. So Democrats are certainly jumping on this opportunity.
Nancy Pelosi saying Rumsfeld should resign, and she wasn't the only Democrat picking up that theme today.
Right. I mean, a number of them. And people who, you know, sometimes have been very supportive of the Bush administration, or at least on the Iraq policy. Joe Biden had some very critical things to say about Rumsfeld. And, you know, it's hard to know where this story goes. But, I don't think end in Rumsfeld resigning or being fired by President Bush. But it certainly got the Bush administration off message.
Rumsfeld was in New Delhi today in India talking with his counterpart there, the Indian defense minister. What did he have to say as this story continued to roil around the world?
He, in essence, called the exchange with Specialist Wilson very constructive, and he said that it's good for senior bishop, administration and Pentagon officials to have this opportunity to talk to troops, and that someone should sit down with Specialist Wilson and find out what was concerning him about the armor situation. So certainly he said it was something that was helpful to him, for him to know what troops were concerned about, and something he hoped to do in the future.
Though I have to say, he did appear to be kind of knocked off his famously confident stride yesterday in Kuwait, at least for a moment there.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've been in these town hall meetings with Rumsfeld when he meets with troops, and there is always a lot of or some degree of grumbling, and that's what troops do. I mean, they grumble about their pay and sometimes grumble about how long they're in a combat zone. But this did seem to have a different tone in the sense that Specialist Wilson's question and the cheering that it received and a number of questions afterwards were more combative than they have been in other town hall meetings. And I think this did surprise Rumsfeld.
Senator Christopher Dodd saying today that his response was utterly unacceptable, especially the bit about you going to war with the army you have. He said, "Mr. Secretary, our troops go to war with the army that our nation's leaders provide." President Bush has talked a lot about providing whatever the army, the military needs. What did he have to say today?
Well, President Bush, in many ways, tried to play both sides in that he tried to say that, you know, Specialist Wilson's question was a legitimate one, and it's certainly legitimate for troops going into combat to make sure or question why they don't have the best equipment. And at the same time, he supported Rumsfeld. But, Bush is in a somewhat difficult spot because throughout the campaign, he criticized Senator Kerry for not being supportive of the troops. And he said that, you know, his administration was committed to equipping the troops in the best way possible. So this was something that he didn't want to have to deal with, but I think the White House felt like it had to address.
Donald Rumsfeld has a history of boiling things down to kind of blunt what he presents as simple truths. You know, nothing's perfect, freedom's untidy, stuff happens. Is this something the troops and the military in general are used to? Or is there some kind of frustration building with the Secretary of Defense as circumstances on the ground turn out very clearly not to be nearly as straightforward as many in the military must have been led to think a couple of years ago?
Well, as you say, Rumsfeld likes sparring, and he likes sparring with the press. And these were the types of answers he would give in a typical press briefing to Pentagon reporters as they go back and forth. I think he had an audience problem yesterday, and that he used that answer for troops who are going into Iraq, who are very legitimately concerned about what they might experience and whether they were properly equipped. So I think that's why his remarks came across to some as callous, because he wasn't talking to reporters. He wasn't talking to, in a speech. He was talking to people who were going into harm's way. And I think that's why it's resonated and put Rumsfeld in a little bit of hot water on this.
And we heard there, after Specialist Wilson's comment, his question, and what he says, we do not have proper vehicles to carry us north. You heard that big hall just erupt with cheers for this very challenging question. Might part of this be that this is a different crew? That this is not, these are mainly guardsmen and reserves. They're older. They've been around a little more. Maybe they just feel more confident in challenging Donald Rumsfeld.
And that's a great point. And I think that's something to look at in the future. Right now, there's about 40% of the force in Iraq is reservists and National Guard. That's going to go up with the next rotation.
And this is already a very high percentage in such a hot spot.
It is a high percentage. And as you say, these tend to be people, again, who are not career military. They don't have as much concern about a future in the military, so they may be a little less hesitant to mouth off or talk to reporters or talk to the Secretary of Defense about their problems and so or complain about the situation. So I think this would be something that we'd have to watch for in the future as the percentage of reservists and National Guardsmen goes up in Iraq.
And of course, they've taken material steps as well. There was the unit that refused to go out on the fuel convoy that was recently disciplined for that. There were the 8 soldiers now in Iraq and Kuwait filing a lawsuit about that the stop-loss policy that doesn't let them out at the end of their enlistment period. There was another soldier, a woman from North Carolina, who challenged Rumsfeld on that yesterday. Is the sense, as you look out on this, that they have good cause for a complaint, given what's going on in Iraq, given, as you say, that it was a full year, nearly a year, after President Bush ended major combat operations or declared an end, that soldiers even had protective plates to put in their protective vests? They had those vests but no armor inside for a long time. Are they justified in being unhappy and complaining?
Well, I mean, there's two issues, first is the supply issue, and people will tell you very frankly that the insurgency sort of caught the U.S. supply system off guard. No one was expecting this insurgency, and so they weren't producing armored Humvees. They didn't equip every soldier in Iraq with plates for flak vests because they were only going to go to quote-unquote frontline troops. Mm-hmm. Well, as we discovered, the front line was pretty much anywhere in Iraq, so they had to catch up there. On your question about the reservists, there is also some very legitimate concerns, I think, about the equipment reservists get as opposed to active duty troops.
And that was one of the complaints, again, raised yesterday in Kuwait. This trooper saying, we've got antiquated equipment, what's up?
That's right, and in many cases they do, and they have, and people say at the Pentagon, you know, if we wanted to give them all the best equipment, we should have done this 10 years ago. It's not something you can immediately fix. Now, what Rumsfeld and others have said is that there's going to be a priority that those who are going into the greatest danger will get the best equipment.
But he said somebody has to get the older gear, and I guess it's you if you're not at that particular front line.
That's right, and so the better gear supposedly will go to those in the hot spots in Iraq.
We're going to talk a lot more about this, but I guess the question that inside the Pentagon: do you smell a fear that there's a real morale problem here, that they may see, or already seeing, difficult pushback from troops who feel themselves in an untenable situation?
It's difficult to tell, especially gauging just on this one town hall meeting. There is certainly a concern that by delaying the tours of duty of troops in Iraq, which they just announced last week that they would do, and by raising the number of troops in Iraq, that you might have a morale problem on your hands. And they watch these retention and recruitment numbers very closely. But I don't sense yet that they think that they're at a breaking point, or that, you know, whatever Specialist Wilson said or is indicative of widespread sentiment in Iraq. But it's certainly something going into next year that they're going to be looking at.
We're going to hear more about that in this hour. Mark Mazzetti, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Mazzetti is the Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with me from Washington. You're listening to On Point. Joining me now from Washington is retired General William Nash. He retired as a major general after 34 years in the Army. He served in Vietnam, in the Gulf War, in Bosnia. He's now a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. General Nash, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Good evening. Good to be with you.
Great to have you. Also with me in the studio tonight, Stephen Van Evra, professor of political science and in the Security Studies program at MIT. He's author of Causes of War, Power, and the Roots of Conflict. Stephen Van Evra, welcome back to On Point. Good to have you.
Good to be here.
General Nash, to you first. How do you interpret what you have no doubt seen along with the rest of the world yesterday? Is this just bumptious troopers blowing off some steam, or do we have a military that's got some problems emerging here, some morale fault lines?
Well, first off, I got to say, God bless the American soldier. If the generals won't speak up, at least the soldiers will.
Amen.
And, it's been a long tradition of the American soldier to ask hard questions of their bosses. And whether it's a platoon leader talking to 30 or 40 folks, or the Secretary of Defense talking to a town hall meeting type setting, you can expect them to ask you hard questions and try to understand what's up.
So are Private Wilson and the rest of those who spoke up so pugnaciously yesterday going to have their wrists slapped off screen, or this is just A-OK?
Well, you know, it depends on how the chain of command reacts. There's obviously a concern that some of their bosses might get too worked up over it. But the fact of the matter is they asked legitimate questions. They asked about pay. They asked about how long they were going to be in the Army and how long these stop-loss procedures. And they asked about their whether or not the government was doing enough to provide them the very best questions. All very legitimate. We ought to worry more about answering the questions than we should worry about the questions that were asked.
I hear that. Stephen Van Evra, let me bring that straight to you. Is the emperor being called here, you know, on his nakedness? Are there real problems that these troops are pointing to that others have, for whatever reason, not been as effective in raising publicly with this very tough-minded Secretary of Defense?
I think Specialist Thomas Wilson asked a great question, and his question is a symptom of a bigger problem. I think the whole intervention in Iraq has been under-resourced from the beginning. Too few troops, too little money, too little management expertise at the top. The troops have been let down. I sum it up in three ways. They're not being properly equipped for the fight they face right now.
Mm.
We see that with the complaints yesterday. The second problem is that they've been given a war they shouldn't have been given. The Iraqi army and police ought to be taking the brunt of this fight, and they aren't doing it because we've moved too slowly to train up a new Iraqi army and police. And again, the training of the new Iraqi army has been under-resourced. It never should have been disbanded to begin with. That was a blunder. Once it's disbanded, there should have been much more energy put into the project of creating a new Iraqi army. And the third is that the whole project in Iraq has been under-resourced from the get-go.
Why? Why? Surely everybody wanted to win. Why not resource to win?
Well, I think the administration sort of has three blinders, with one causing the other. They've been relentlessly too optimistic from the get-go about how this war would go. They didn't foresee the insurgency. They thought that a crushing conventional victory would deter insurgents of all kinds. The plan didn't work out. Second, their style of operating in the world in general is to do plan A without plan B. Rumsfeld's famous for arguing that people should think positive, not negative.
And just get going.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, that bleeds over into being reckless, and, you know, you better worry. In war, you better have plan B because the enemy's out there and may goof up plan A. And across the board, this administration tends to do things without plan B. They're doing it in the economy, you know, with their fiscal plans.
But we're looking at those soldiers tonight, and they did not look happy getting ready to go into Iraq. We're going to hear a lot more tonight. We're going to hear from in a moment from NPR's Ann Garrels. William Nash, General William Nash in Washington. Stephen Van Ever right here with me in Boston. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. We are talking about Donald Rumsfeld's earful from the troops. You can join the conversation. Did you hear the guardsmen in reserve standing up and grilling the Secretary of Defense in Kuwait? What did you make of it? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Donald Rumsfeld's earful from the troops and what it says about military morale and the war in Iraq. I'm joined tonight by retired Army General William Nash. He joins us from Washington. He's now senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He served in Vietnam, Iraq, and Bosnia. Stephen Van Ever is with us from MIT. You can join this conversation as well. Did you hear the guardsmen and reserves standing up and grilling the Secretary of Defense in Kuwait yesterday? Did these sound to you like nervous Nellies, like whiners, or like American soldiers with real, credible issues? And what about Rumsfeld's response? What do you think? Was he cavalier? Was he dismissive in his reply? Or was he just being honest with the troops? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined right now, and very happy to be, from Connecticut by Ann Garrels, NPR correspondent who has spent a lot of time in the theater of the Iraq War, author of the book Naked in Baghdad. She just came back from Iraq 10 days ago. She's been embedded with a Marine rifle company there and did some terrific reporting from in and around Fallujah. Ann Garrels, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
So you saw the exchange, heard the exchange, no doubt, yesterday between Rumsfeld and the troops. You felt the frustration from these troops who weren't even in Iraq yet. We're hoping you can give us a sense, Anne, of the troops inside, those doing the fighting, those really in harm's way. How's morale? How do they think they're being led and supplied?
Well, the supply issue has been a major one all along. This issue of not having enough armored vehicles has been going on for months and months and months, and has been, you know, I've heard it again and again and again, people using their flak jackets, taking off their flak jackets in order to line the vehicles or put it on the bed of a vehicle because there was simply not enough armor. I have to say, in general, I mean, morale, you know, when the Marines I was with, you know, they'd only been in Iraq for a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. They wanted to come in. They supported the president. They support as commander in chief.
Right.
But you know, their picture, frankly, is very narrow. They'd only been in Iraq for about 3 weeks before they got into Fallujah.
Mm-hmm.
They had no idea that they might well be staying in Fallujah. Not just for a few weeks. It wasn't going to be, they thought it was a quick victory. They were going to go in, they got rid of the insurgents, and then they sort of said, okay, fine, now we want to go.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I looked at them and I said, well, you know, I think you might actually be here longer than you think. And lo and behold, they will be, because Iraqi security forces are in no position to go in and assert control in Fallujah. And at which point they sort of went, oh,
How long might that be?
Right.
And
you know, they don't want to be policemen, but they are going to be policemen.
So you saw troops that were pretty fresh in. They went straight into a very fierce firefight, not much time for second thoughts there. And yet you know the kind of word that's coming out of Iraq, the CIA classified cable that was reported on this week, where the station chief from Baghdad came out saying the situation there is deteriorating, it's getting worse, and it's going to be bad for a long time. You know, we're reading military analysts saying that if you look Iraq-wide, the soldiers see the country now as one big whack-a-mole. You know, you whack it down here and it pops up there. And as you
That's
say,
right.
They don't even have the armor in a country where every trash bag and sheep's carcass can blow you up.
No surprise to any of us. I've been there now for over 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, the day the American troops arrived in Baghdad, I mean, there, you know, the cameras showed buoyant, joyous Iraqis. Well, that was a close-up. There weren't enough Iraqis to pull down that statue of Saddam Hussein.
Yep.
The Marines had to do it
mm-hmm.
because there weren't enough people. Most people were standing on the sidelines going, oh, my God. Yes, they may have been thrilled to see Saddam go, but Iraqis had told me in the months running up to the U.S. invasion, they anticipated the looting. They anticipated that Saddam and Sunni extremists would go underground. They anticipated that there could well be a civil war. Clearly, the administration did not anticipate any of those things and were ill-prepared for it. And the situation is indeed getting worse.
So the question then is whether the sort of rank-and-file military and the higher brass are going to stay on board or begin to push back, begin to really make complaint about this. I mean, we're reading...
The military doesn't do that, though.
No how, no way, not even want to get in deep. I mean, we're reading complaints here that they say there's no end game here, the mission is undefined, we go and fight here, then we go and fight there. How does this add up to a victory? U.S. military is trained to want a victory.
That's true. And the military, the burden has been put on the military from day one. You know, the civilians have been locked in the green zone, not going out because of security concerns. From very early on, there are virtually no non-governmental organizations working in Iraq. It is the military who is providing both or trying to provide security, which it doesn't have the numbers to do, and it is also doing the construction projects because the contractors are afraid to go out and do them. So they are doing, I mean, the military, they are doing the democracy building project. The military is doing everything. In many ways, the military realized early on that the programs put forward by the civilians in the Pentagon, by Paul Bremer, then the civilian occupation administrator, of de-Ba'athification, getting rid of the Iraqi military, had probably been a mistake. But their views were not heeded.
And so the burden is very much on their shoulders. And as you say, Anne, when they come out fresh and they're gung-ho to do the necessary, but here we've got fresh soldiers from a different quarter already coming out a little bit skeptical and voices wondering. And we're so grateful for your reporting from Iraq and grateful for you being with us briefly tonight. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
NPR correspondent Ann Garrels. General Nash, let me come to you with that for just a moment. Ann Garrels says the military doesn't complain. They don't buck the orders. And yet this is a big experiment underway, a big experiment in going in light, as Stephen Van Evra is saying, and Ann, too, this whole thing under-resourced, at least in the view of many from the get-go. Is there a conversation now within the uniformed military about what's going on there, whether it's being properly led, whether the right resources are going to it or not? Are they just saluting and forging ahead?
Well, I think you would underestimate the patriotism and the competence of the senior military leaders that are trying to deal with the situation. In particular, John Abizade is the CENTCOM commander, and George Casey is our commander in Baghdad, are two officers that I know extremely well, and I know they're working the issues about as hard as they can. Now, they're not going to work them in the Los Angeles Times or on NPR. They're going to work them within the chain of command.
But when you say work them, does that mean they're kicking up their heels and saying, gosh darn it, we've got to have X, Y, and Z? President Bush says they'll have whatever they ask for.
Well, and as we just saw, for the first time in a year and three quarters, based on a request from General Casey in Baghdad, there was a plus-up of 12,000 soldiers for the election.
Mm-hmm. Up to 150,000.
And that's the first time that we know of in the last couple of years when we've conventional wisdom certainly has concluded that there had been insufficient forces in Iraq, that the commanders have pressed for and succeeded in gaining additional forces, despite the fact that it was a little bit late, given the fact that with the American election, I know they didn't want to, the administration didn't want to make the announcement prior to our election.
It's on November 3rd, but now they've got it going toward the Iraqi election in January. Even if it hurts, to make it happen. I want to begin to bring our callers in here. A lot have been waiting. We're at 1-800-423-8255, and Frank is calling from North Carolina. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening, Frank. What's on your mind?
Well, just listening to the conversation. I was driving tonight. I'm coming back from a military assignment here stateside this year. I was over last year. And
in Iraq?
In the Mideast, yes.
Okay.
During the initial war fighting. And there were some problems then, but, you know, the American soldier is going to fight. And I've been in close to over 30 years. And young or old, they're going to fight, and they're not going to criticize in a negative way. And I applaud the specialist that spoke yesterday. I did not see the whole interview, but one thing is very clear to me. It is not a command climate to where our senior leadership, much less troops like yesterday, are given a chance to speak openly about it. Right now, the situation is much like what Ann Garrels covered very well. A lot of patriotic people that are in a fight that's very politically driven right now, and we're doing the best we can. And that's what an American soldier is going to do, man or woman, right now.
Frank, you were there. You must have seen some of the shortages that began to emerge pretty quickly. Did they look reasonable to you? Donald Rumsfeld says, well, look, we're doing the best that we can. Is that how it felt? Is that how it feels to your fellow troopers?
And it wasn't a matter of physics then. It's not a matter of physics now. It's a matter of priority. And quite frankly, that it's I'm spitting metal right now. You know, it's just one of those situations that should not occur.
You mean the lack of armor that Specialist Wilson was talking about?
It's just not that. It's just the lack of priority. It's politically driven right now. And if you look at any good military strategy, which I'm not going to get into in detail, but we went in to fight one kind of war and against an Iraqi army. We did not make the shift to the type of fighting that needs to be done now. What we have now is a lot of soldiers that are a lot of targets. And, you know, we are caught in the middle of now being seen much like a domestic dispute when a police officer walk into a civilian situation. You know, we're being attacked on both sides. And by God's grace, we need our leadership support right now. And that right now, quite frankly, I don't have very much confidence in, and I'm an independent as far as political affiliation. But, you know, this issue's got to be addressed, and Donald Rumsfeld's got to get something more than the statements that were made yesterday.
What's your rank in the Army, Frank, if I may ask?
I'm a staff sergeant.
Frank, thanks very much for your call.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are joined now from Washington by Gary Anderson. He's a retired Marine colonel, adjunct fellow at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies. He has been in operations in Somalia, the Philippines, served as chief of staff at the Marine Corps Warfighting Lab in Quantico. Gary Anderson, Colonel Anderson, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Good evening.
So we're looking at this exchange we saw yesterday between troops getting ready to go into Iraq and the Secretary of Defense and trying to gauge what it means. What's behind the heat of the soldiers who were gathered there and the cheering when these tough questions were asked? How did you interpret what you saw there yesterday, Colonel Anderson?
Well, you know, I take a little bit different cut on it than some do.
Okay.
And I'm probably a prisoner of having spent maybe too much time in the service myself. But you know, as a commander, the one thing I never wanted to do when I asked the troops what they thought was to hear a stony silence, because that meant, A, they were afraid to speak their mind, or, B, they'd given up.
Right.
You know, they didn't feel that it would do any good. And, you know, and I think the fact that these soldiers, and these are citizen soldiers, these are your National Guardsmen, and
definitely.
So they're not wedded to, you know, the careerism and so forth. So they, you know, they're not going to be at all hesitant to voice their concerns. So I think a certain amount of letting off steam is healthy, and then they've got some legitimate concerns.
So you look at the exchange as healthy, but should American soldiers have to be complaining about armor at this stage in a conflict? Don't we have the resources to get things properly done? Donald Rumsfeld says, well, it's a matter of physics, as if factories just couldn't be built quickly enough or geared up quickly enough. Is it a matter of physics, or is it a matter of the way the war has been managed? Is there a legitimate complaint here?
I think the question is, and I think I suspect that Secretary Rumsfeld, being the manager that he is going to go back and say, are we producing enough Kevlar? Are we really at maximum capacity? That would be the question. I don't know the answer to that. But if the pipeline is such that we're at maximum capacity and doing everything we can, obviously there's not a heck of a lot you can do about it. If, in fact, there are mechanisms to get that stuff out there faster, I suspect that he's going to be asking those questions based on that the response that he got from the troops.
But one would think he might have been asking those questions some time ago, given that the war is on at full tilt. Let me take another call here. Suzanne is calling from Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. Hi, Suzanne. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Just great, Suzanne.
No,
what's on your mind?
I just wanted to make a comment. I have seen this country gear up for war too many times. But the leadership is incompetent. What I referred to the young man is about 6 months ago, there was an article in the Central paper that a young reservist had come home on leave, and she was taking the cast-off bulletproof vest from the major city's police forces to take back because there weren't enough.
She didn't have the proper armor in Iraq, so she was taking it from police force at home.
Yes.
It doesn't seem like that's the way the supply chain ought to work, ideally, Suzanne.
No, it doesn't. I mean, I remember World War II, and we certainly geared up and got them, and it's just incompetent, these poor young men. I have no one over there, but I cry every time somebody gets killed because it's not necessary. They do not have what they need. I also talked to a gentleman who was a veteran here in town, and he reported he'd been told that some group that they were in only got to eat once a day. Well, when you're busy getting shot at, you don't mind not eating. But I do know that during World War II in Korea, it was not that way.
You've watched and you've seen it look better, at least from where you stand. Suzanne in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky, thanks so much for your call. Stephen Van Evra, what about the fundamental question here? Is there a lack of capacity to equip these troops with the industrial might of the United States, or is it, as we heard from our trooper in North Carolina, is it a priority issue?
We absolutely have the capacity to equip them properly, and the reason they're not equipped properly is because the administration has been way too optimistic throughout this whole guerrilla war, denying that the insurgency was there back in July 2003 with Rumsfeld dismissing people who said, gee, aren't we facing an insurgency? And he wouldn't even use the word. And then moving on through the next 12 months, relentlessly underestimating the size of the insurgency. First, remember, there was 4,000 to 6,000 insurgents out there, and everyone on the ground said, no, there's way more than that. Mm-hmm. Now, finally, the number's up to 8,000 to 12,000, and most people who are close to it say, no, the number's way bigger. Who knows how big? It might be 50,000.
So, and it's not primarily foreigners. It's primarily Iraqis.
Correct. And as a result, they've simply underprepared for it. And one of the things they've done wrong is not building enough equipment for the troops. When this country gets serious about building equipment, we can do it fast and we can do it well. In World War II, when we needed to build tanks, we took over Detroit and had Detroit build tanks. And I look at what Detroit's doing right now, and it's building a lot of SUVs. It should be building the armored equipment we need for these troops. I'm looking right now at a Bloomberg release saying
yes,
that Armor Holdings, which makes protective plates for Humvees, said today on Bloomberg that it could increase output by 22% per month with no investment, and it is waiting for an order from the Army.
It hasn't been asked. Why go to war on the cheap? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Colonel Anderson, General Nash, Stephen Van Evra, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Donald Rumsfeld's earful from the troops in Kuwait and what it says about military morale and the war in Iraq. I'm joined tonight from Washington by retired Marine Colonel Gary Anderson, and also from Washington by retired Army General William Nash. With me in the studio, Stephen Van Evra from MIT's Security Studies Program. You can join this conversation as well. Donald Rumsfeld said, "You go to war with the army you have, not the one you want." Is he right in this case? And if he is, does that excuse the apparent planning failures in for Iraq? Is it reasonable, nearly 2 years into the war, for U.S. troops to be under-equipped in Iraq? And is America still trying to do this war on the cheap with soldiers paying the price? You can join us tonight, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dave is calling from Peabody, Massachusetts. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show, as always.
Thanks, Dave. What's on your mind?
I'm a military reservist, and I was very angered by Mr. Rumsfeld's comments yesterday. I found them to be, as you said earlier, both cavalier and dismissive, and I applaud the sergeant or the specialist who spoke up, and I think he said what a lot of the troops are feeling.
Well, I mean, I was asking if it was cavalier or just honest. Why do you say cavalier, Dave?
Because this problem is nothing new. That's what bothers me the most about it. The troops have been complaining for many months about the shortage of armored vehicles and vests and whatnot. And for Mr. Rumsfeld to pretend as if it was a new, a new problem, and the president as well, they act as if the troops will get whatever they need, and they've been saying that all along. But the reality is, the troops don't have what they need, and I find that disgraceful, quite frankly.
And the bullets are flying and the roadside bombs are going off. Dave, you're a reservist. How do you interpret why this is the case? If there's an undersupply issue, why?
I don't know. I can't speak to the supply issue. I just think, in general, this administration is incompetent.
Well, that's a simple word. Dave, thanks very much for your call. Let's get another call here. Craig is calling from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Hi, Craig. You're on the air.
Hey, how are we doing, Dave? Thanks
Good.
For the call.
Sure. What's on your mind, Craig?
I just like to say I'm active duty, and we have an annual budget, and we don't always get what we need, even on an annual budget. When we were in Iraq, and we couldn't get armor plating for our Humvees, we made do with what we could. We found big old pieces of iron, and we would just make doors for our Humvees.
So you've done a tour or two in Iraq?
I sure have, twice.
And when you heard Specialist Wilson talking about digging through junkyards to find bits of metal, you've been there and done that?
Yeah, I sure have, and it's just like the military teaches you, and anybody who's active duty will know. I mean, I don't know how the National Guard and Reserve are, but we have a constant saying, you have to adapt and overcome. Sometimes you're not going to get what you need all the time. Supply
yep.
systems,
right.
convoys get ambushed in Iraq, and, your supplies get cut off sometimes.
Craig, let me ask you, you're active duty, you've done two tours in Iraq. You hear the complaint there, and you're applauding the soldier for having made it. Do you think that this is now or might in the future affect military morale in Iraq, affect the operations of the U.S. military there?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say. I can say our morale in Iraq was very high, even with the supply shortages,
mm-hmm.
and that's all on the individual chain of command. I do applaud the Special Sergeant for stepping up and saying something, because a lot of times you get scared by your leadership for, voicing your opinion just because you don't want to fear the wrath sometimes later on down the road.
Right. Well, he sounded like one bold soldier yesterday. Craig, thanks very much for calling. General Nash, I wanted to ask you about exactly that phrase of Donald Rumsfeld, that you go to war with the army you have, not the one you want. Does that seem like an appropriate rule of thumb to be applying to the American invasion of Iraq? Is that the right attitude?
Well, you see, unfortunately, it doesn't apply to Iraq because that was a war of choice. The issue is that you can certainly argue that the war in Afghanistan, given the requirement to react to the events of 9/11,
and that was Al Qaeda's base, and something had to be done.
Al Qaeda's base, and you go with as you got, and we went with what we had in
mm-hmm.
World War II and the mm-hmm. like. But at the same time, if you look at the strategy that the nation has used throughout its history, it has marshaled the resources necessary to be victorious. And the delays, for example, in D-Day, initially we wanted to do it in early 43, but because of the lack of resources, it was delayed until June of 1944.
Mm-hmm.
When you fight a war of choice and you decide that you're going to deal with the issue of Iraq, the failure to deal with the planning, the misjudgments, and the understanding of the consequences of regime change is the big black mark against the administration. So, yes, you do go to war sometimes with the army that you have because circumstances dictate. But when you fight a war of choice, you certainly need to marshal it. And somebody earlier used the expression anticipation. Stephen said that by July of 2003, it was clear that there was an insurgency.
Yes.
I described it at the time as the counterattack was beginning.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is, if you look back at the events of March and April of 2003, you could see the basic tactics developing. Now, I won't fault somebody for not figuring it out right then, but certainly by July, you should have realized that this was coming on.
So why haven't those insights unfolded into practice? We hear a couple of things. Let me run them by you and see what you think. One, Donald Rumsfeld is so committed to the lighter, faster military that when more resources were needed, he didn't want to hear it. Or two, that there was a kind of a neocon ideological determination to get into Iraq. They didn't want to hear about the problems. Do you see those as behind this or something else?
Well, there are a great number of people, and I think I'm one of them that anticipated before the war that there was A, insufficient forces, B, a lack of understanding of the consequences of the invasion. There was never a doubt as to the military victory that would remove Saddam Hussein from power. But that's very, very different, and this is what the administration did not understand. Regime change is one thing. Stability is another. And there's just been a long series from before day one, in fact, of misjudgments and bad assumptions. And whether it was ideological or the lack of wisdom, I can't really account for.
Stephen Van Evra, I wonder how do you see this? We've heard then a lot about how the weight gets shifted onto the soldiers to kind of make up the difference. And we can hear it in their voices tonight. They call up. They may be mad about the supply issues. They say we're willing to do what's asked of us. But put this in a historical context. Is it right to ask what's being asked of U.S. soldiers to sort of make up the gap in planning and resources? Is it ethical what's being asked here?
Well, I admire the can-do attitude of some of the callers. Craig from North Carolina saying basically, you know, we'll make do with whatever we're given. And that's a marvelous attitude. But the civilians have let our troops down here. And instead of Rummy saying, you fight with the army you got, he should have said, I apologize for not giving you the force you deserve. Because American forces deserve to be fully and properly equipped. They also deserve to not be even in this fight. To me, a terrible mistake's been made asking our troops to conduct this counterinsurgency. We're not good at counterinsurgency. We should have built up an Iraqi force to handle this. And that operation has been under-resourced. You remember last summer when General Dave Petraeus was complaining that his operation for training the Iraqi army only had half the staff he needed. So there's layer upon layer upon layer of under-resourcing here that have put our troops, as you say, in the front line where they're getting hurt.
So how long can that go on before something breaks? Either the country has to step up and apply a lot more resources to this, or is there a chance that the military itself begins to push back despite their, you know, can-do attitude, and they are patriotic, they follow orders, but is there a way in which the military begins to resist and a message goes to the planners, to the civilian leadership here?
Well, I think our military are very tough folk, and they follow orders, and they do their best with tough circumstance. But in the end, I think we're going to have to make big changes in Iraq. We've got to put much more energy into training an Iraqi force that can handle this insurgency instead of putting our own people in the way. And we've got to solve this equipment problem immediately.
Doug's calling from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Very well, thanks. What's on your mind, Doug?
Well, I agree with the undermanning and the undersupply issue. Historically, the Army supply systems have been very slow, but I've been in the Army for 20 years. Over the last 3 years, I've seen it accelerate to, you know, just an unknown speed. Equipment's being purchased over the shelf, shipped overseas. A lot of creative things are being done to get the troops the equipment that they need. What I don't see, on the other hand, in my community here or my community back home.
And you're in a big military community there.
I am, yeah. But in the civilian community here and you know, my community back home where I grew up, you don't see an awareness in the non-military public aside from, you know, the moral support for the troops that's there.
The yellow ribbons are there.
Roger, the pressure for, you know, getting them properly funded, equipped, and manned is there. But you don't see the kind of sacrifice that you would have seen, you know, 70 years ago. I'm not saying that kind of economic sacrifice is needed by the general populace. But you get the sense that it's an issue that's out of sight, out of mind. As long as it doesn't hit my pocketbook, I'm okay with it.
Doug, we've got it, and thank you very much for that observation. Colonel Anderson, let me come to you. Is there a gap here? And if there is, whose fault is it? Is the civilian leadership being sufficiently forthright about the the burden that fighting this war in Iraq means is civilian America stepping up to put on the pressure to keep the troops supported.
Well, I think one of the things that we probably need to, I can't remember which individual that was talking mentioned it, but I hear the word we and us here a lot in this conversation.
Hmm.
And I think that the point is, and your commentator made the good point, is that we need to really be concentrating on making this about the Iraqis and getting General Petraeus, I know, is doing a great job in trying to bring the Iraqis up to speed and probably catching up for a lot of time that we lost.
But that seems to just not be a successful project. I mean, time after time we see, if not busloads of recruits being killed, we see the Iraqi troops and police vanishing when everything hits the fan.
Well, in the Battle of Fallujah, we've had a number of units, Iraqi units that perform credibly. You don't build an army overnight, and it takes a lot of effort to do it. And I think that that when people say we need more troops in Iraq and we need more, every troop that you put in Iraq, you're putting in three or four people that have to support them. And in a nonlinear war, you got people, every one of those people has to have body armor
mm-hmm.
and be supported. I really think that the emphasis here needs to be to get the Iraqis up to speed to start doing what they should be doing. Not throwing more Americans into it. I think that's what General Abizade said the other day, and I have a tendency to agree with him.
Let's get one more call here. David's calling from Fort Bragg. Fort Bragg's really calling in tonight. David, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
What I called about was I'd like to really ask that you change the dynamics of this conversation. The Humvee is considered a first-generation, or at least a up-armored Humvee, a first-generation mine-protected anti-ambush-type vehicle.
The ones that have all the armor, of course, many do not still at this point.
That is correct. And there are issues with the production and getting the armor on the vehicles, but I believe that the real issue is, as a first-generation vehicle, it doesn't do enough. Right now, we have a company out of South Carolina producing the Cougar and the Buffalo vehicles, which are a fourth-generation vehicle in this class of mine-protecting vehicles. And I know the Marine Corps has done a lot to try and push these. The Army is also pushing these a lot. And they've been in use in Afghanistan and Iraq for the last couple of years.
David, we're almost out of time, but we hear it. A better armored vehicle that's in production out there, but then we read 8,000 unarmored Humvees still in use in Iraq and Afghanistan as we talk tonight. Stephen Evra, I'm hearing two things here. On the one hand, supply the troops better. On the other, get the Iraqis trained up, and you say, along with that, a real reconsideration of overall strategy.
Well, the buildup of the Iraqi army is essential to any success, and we should be putting all our efforts toward making that work. And I think that operation, too, is under-resourced. As I said, Petraeus complains he doesn't have enough. Hey, he's only a half the staff he needs in his headquarters.
So we just had a re-election. President Bush is back in. So is Rumsfeld. What flips the trigger to a new attitude here or a new approach, if not
well,
that?
Well, the administration's got to start listening to its critics. That's one of the fundamental problems here. This administration's whole management style is well known. They use their staff to justify policy, not to analyze it. They isolate themselves. They don't like to hear suggestions from below on improvement. We heard some of the callers saying this. Frank in North Carolina was talking about how troops aren't really given the chance to speak, and Craig
the command climate
about fear.
Not friendly to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the problem here is the civilians are not welcoming criticism from below, and they're not listening to what can be said from below. So they're not learning fast, and they're not adjusting fast. And it's got to do with the failure to listen.
Well, they got a big earful yesterday, and the whole world heard it right along with Donald Rumsfeld. Stephen Van Evra with MIT Security Studies Program. Thank you so much for being here tonight. And Colonel Gary Anderson in Washington, adjunct fellow at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies, thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you.
And General Nash in Washington, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, very good to have you.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.